You are listening to WZBC Boston College Radio 90.3 FM. This program is called Sounds of Dissent. And I'm Petrina here filling in for host John Grebe, who is headed down to the RNC in New York, where I'll be heading myself later on today. But we have an extended program today. We'll be here until 2 o'clock, so stay tuned, stay with us. Our next guest is a journalist. His name is Ian Williams. But first, I will let you know that we are also going to be having a representative from United for Justice with Peace on the phone at about 1:15. Tony Palumba will give us an update on what will be going on with the march that is being organized by United for Justice with Peace. That's at about 1:15, and then at the end of the program, we'll have some headlines as contributed from my colleague Manjusri. So, again, I'm Petrina filling in for John Grebe, and my guest right now on the phone from New York, Ian Williams, is a veteran journalist, media consultant, and the UN correspondent for The Nation magazine. He is also the author of the new book, Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. Welcome to Sounds of Dissent.
Hi, nice to be here, Patrick.
And so you were on MSNBC the other night, and I hear there was some controversy around what was discussed.
Yeah, well, we actually had on the same show two of the Swift Boat veterans, and if anything confirmed the lasting damage that Vietnam inflicted on a lot of people, it was these two guys who no amount of argument or evidence was going to shake them from their unshakable belief that the Vietnam War was winnable, that what they were doing was a good thing, that no atrocities existed, and that John Kerry was an evil person for suggesting that they had. I mean, it's the hatred burning after 30 years was really, really tangible. It was interesting as well because, of course, I texted Dave Gardner, who is one of the leading Swift Boat veterans for truth, and said, you know, excuse me, why are you so worried about John Kerry, who, by your own testimony, was actually there in Vietnam? Why aren't you concerned about George W. Bush, who used his family influence to evade service in Vietnam by going into the National Guard and then went missing for a year? And all he could say was, why'd you bring that up? And, well, I had to answer, well, because it's his minions who are paying for your television adverts. That's why I'm bringing it up. But he must have been programmed by Karl Grove not to sort of to self-destruct if he said anything actually in support of Bush. He was very careful not to try to defend him in the slightest, which was a bit disappointing, really.
Right. So we have actually figured out a sort of crude way to take questions from listeners. If anyone has a question for Ian Williams, who is my guest here on Sounds of Dissent, you can tune in. I mean, you can call 617-552-3511, and my colleague Tracy will take your call and give me your question. But as far as the Swift Boat veterans go, can you tell me more about what's happening in the world today with that?
Well, I think it's to the rest of the world, in fact, it's amazing that a 40-year-old war and the behavior of individuals in it should be dominating the issue. Is you have a country with this, a massive deficit, the biggest deficit in history, both on budget and balance of payments. You have increasing poverty. We saw this week that the number of uninsured and the number of people living below poverty went up. You have a war that looks like an action replay of Vietnam from 40 years ago going on now in Iraq. With all of this going on, and people are talking about whether or not Lieutenant Kerry got rice pellets unintentionally or intentionally in his buttocks and whether it was worth a Purple Heart or not. That's bizarre enough, but the fact that the people who are raising this are doing so on behalf of a president who actually dodged the whole war while supporting it makes it even more bizarre. I mean, it makes you wonder, what's this election about after all? It's quite disturbing.
And so you're down in New York, right?
Yes.
And so will you be out on the street tomorrow?
I'll be out there.
What's it like right now?
It's very peaceful. It's good weather. It hasn't rained for a change.
I heard it was supposed to be quite oppressive heat.
I don't know. I've been here too long. Compared with previous summers, this hasn't been too bad.
Right.
But
that's good.
No, it's going to be hot and sticky. And Republicans will all be turning up. Yesterday there were military helicopters beetling around, which was sort of quite spooky. Who knows what they're up to. But it comes back to the issue that, remember, the convention is here so that George W. Bush can capitalize on September the 11th on the attack. He has been trying to present what he is doing in Iraq as a continuation of the war on terror, and he has been fairly successful in convincing a lot of Americans that Iraq was behind September the 11th. And I think the reason that Kerry has sort of walked into this Vietnam ambush now is because he's tried to challenge Bush's war credentials. Bush's big issue is, this is a wartime, we're in a war, you shouldn't change commanders now, or, you know, I am tried and trusted, I was here for September the 11th. And, of course, that is not a feeling shared by most New Yorkers, a huge percentage of whom said they were going to be demonstrated this weekend when polled. I think I'm disappointed, I must say, in John Kerry's response, because he did walk into this ambush over Vietnam, and instead of coming back immediately on the offensive against the Swift Boat smear ads and saying, excuse me, where were you during the big war, George W. Bush? You know, I was there, you weren't. He waited for several weeks before coming back, and now he's beginning to show signs of fighting back. Of course, suddenly George W. Bush wants to put an end to these 527 groups. He wants campaign finance reform. I mean, it really does add to the Alice in Wonderland bit as well, that that Bush is accusing Kerry of having ads paid for by a bunch of billionaires. Well, you know, as though sort of it's the poor of Texas and the rest of the world who are uniting behind Bush at the moment. You don't really see many sort of social security recipients for Bush demonstrations going on, do you?
You're listening to Sounds of Dissent here on Boston College Radio. My guest is Ian Williams, who is a veteran journalist, media consultant, and the UN correspondent for The Nation magazine. And I know we have a little bit of an echo happening here. I'm wondering if you are near a stereo or a...
No.
Like that, no. Okay, well, I'll just keep going. I have a question from a listener. How would you characterize the Bush administration's attitude towards and treatment of U.S. military families with members serving in Iraq?
Well, this is one of the things that the book, as you read out, the title is Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Own Past. So only part of it is about his lack of service in the National Guard. I mean, a real point here is, I suppose I quoted General Wesley Clark. He said that Republicans love weapons systems and Democrats like soldiers. And if you look, while he's been presenting himself as Commander-in-Chief, which he does with sort of bewildering frequency, and while he's always dressing up in military gear and trying to say that he is the protector of the military, in fact, on issue after issue, he has really let them down. On a basic emotional issue, as far as I know, neither he nor Cheney nor any members of the cabinet have been to a single military funeral for the, I believe this morning's figure was 966 dead so far. They tried to hide the pictures of those coffins coming back so that people wouldn't know or wouldn't see en masse the scale of what they're inflicting on their own people, let alone on the Iraqis. Then we have the basic issues. He tried to veto an increase in the death grant for survivors last year. He's tried to get it so that combat pay... they tried to restrict combat pay. They tried to make... soldiers in military hospitals pay for their own meals. I can imagine that's an added insult to injury from what I know of most hospital and military food. So it's on every level. Even the ex-military, he's been cutting back trying to close Veterans Administration hospitals. He's been restricting funding for the Veterans Administration because the medical service there is getting more and more calls and it's getting fewer and fewer resources to deal with them. So on almost every level, he's actually been very mean and penny-pinching towards the actual military themselves, while he's been extra generous to military contractors, like, as we know, Halliburton and Bechtel and all of the others who have if it's not too lugubrious a phrase to use, are making a killing out of the Iraq War.
You are listening to Sounds of Dissent here on Boston College Radio 90.3 FM. And if you have a question for my guest, Ian Williams, you can give us a call at 617-552-3511. And Tracy will give me your question to read to Mr. Williams here on the air. And I do have another question for you, Mr. Williams. And just so you know, the echo is only when I talk. When you talk, it's fine. So how has the treatment of veterans changed under the Bush administration? Have there been changes to the health care benefits and pensions that they receive?
Yes, there have. I know several military people have been complaining to me. Their co-payments have gone up. There have been attempts to close hospitals. The co-payments for medications have gone up in an attempt to sort of try and save some money. And, you know, to be fair, the actual amount of money that's being paid out to being paid out on the Veterans Administration has increased, but that's because it hasn't increased in pace with the demand. Because when you think about it, there's a huge tranche now. You've got the tail end of the post World War II veterans. Join now with the Korean, the Cold War, the whole Cold War, and the Vietnam veterans, all now demanding medical services off the Veterans Administration. And because of collapsing employment and health plans elsewhere, a lot of people who would not have bothered using the VA system are now resorting to it. In the absence of a national health service in this country, then they have no option. So the demands are increasing, and the attempts have been sort of penny-pinching to try and cut back on hospitals and to restrict those. He did try, as I remember last year, to restrict it so that people wouldn't be able to collect a disability and a retirement pension together. So, you know, you would be, in a sense, you would get no compensation for having lost a limb or whatever on behalf of the Uncle Sam. You just get the same pension as everybody else. I believe that was vetoed. I'd have to double check on that. That was overridden by the Congress, who know that in an election year, mean-spirited things like that are not going to win you the votes that they want.
So tell us more about your book. What is it called?
It's called Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Own Past. And it's the perfect antidote to Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, even though we wrote it before. They have, of course, sort of sprung from whatever recovered memory syndrome hole that they've been hiding in for 30 years. And it's not explicitly pro-Kerry by any means. In fact, I don't think we hardly mention him in the course of the book, because it was an examination of George Bush and basically his hypocrisy. And I think that's what a journalist's job is, to examine hypocrisy. So whatever I think about Kerry, he fought in a war and then came back and said that war was bad and he opposed it. What George W. Bush did was to use his family influence as a rich frat kid from at Yale to get into a National Guard unit, which was only open to people similarly rich and privileged. And then he did so explicitly, ticking a box, saying no to overseas service, in other words, to refuse to go to Vietnam. He's confessed since then that his whole purpose in doing so was to avoid going to Vietnam. And what made this really really bad and the sort of total hypocrisy is that, first of all, he actually supported the war in Vietnam and canvassed repeatedly for Republican candidates who supported the war in Vietnam. And then he went missing for a year in Alabama. He basically deserted, hence the title. There's no sign whatsoever that from May 1972 to May 1973 he fulfilled his duty. So taking all of that together and then finding that he and his campaign have tried to make what John Kerry did during the war a campaign issue, or what Senator Max Cleland, the triple amputee, did during the war, it really makes it, this is hypocrisy that needs challenging from whichever side of the political spectrum you come from.
You're listening to Sounds of Dissent here on WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. My guest is Ian Williams. He's a veteran journalist, media consultant, and he is the UN correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's also the author of the new book, Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. And we have a website here with links to our guests and their their information. So if you go to WZBC.org, use the current playlist function, you can follow along with us here on Sounds of Dissent. And we have an extended program today, so stay with us until 2 o'clock. We will have a representative from United for Justice with Peace on the phone after we talk to Ian Williams some more. And I'm Petrina, here filling in for John Grebe with the help of Tracy and Manjusri today. It's just a little bit past 1 o'clock, and we are taking your questions via the phone, and Tracy will give your questions to me if you call 617-552-3511. If you have a question for Mr. Williams, feel free to call. Again, the number is 617-552-3511. 3511. We have a question from John from Wakefield. He saw the debate on, well, it says last night, but it was Thursday night, I believe, on MSNBC, and he wants to know why the media is giving these guys so much attention.
That's the $64,000 question. I mean, this is brilliant work, and it really does have, if I can mix metaphors, the cloven hoof prints of Bush's brain, Karl Rove, all over it. For about $150,000, they buy ads in three small towns. Then they're guaranteed the amplification of Fox and CNN and MSNBC, who repeat the ads over and over and over again and make a big issue of it. Then you find that the mainstream media confess that because the cable stations have picked it up, they have to treat it as a big news item, even though they don't really think it is. And it really shows how this system works. Since deregulation, the fact that Fox is totally unfair and totally unbalanced and is allowed to be so with no sort of public service requirement, that CNN has decided to go down market along with it, has really created this dangerous Murdochian world in which basically a small group, bunch of people with serious post-Vietnam traumatic stress syndrome can dominate the agenda of an election for the leader of the free world, the strongest country in the world. It is bizarre, and it is down to what Rupert Murdoch has managed to do with the world's media. It's a frightening phenomenon. I've been on a lot of these shows with people like O'Reilly and Scarborough, and any sort of hint or pretense of objectivity goes out the window, even as he sort of talks about a no-spin zone or fair and balanced. I mean, this is... as you can tell from my accent, I originally come from Britain, and even Murdoch would not be able to get away with it in Britain, certainly not on the airwaves, because there are occasional calls for objectivity and truth in there, which might be stretched sometimes, but they would not be able to get away with it in almost any other media market.
We have another question from Grace from Cambridge. The caller has a theory on why the polls are showing such a response to the Swift vote ads. She feels that Kerry assumed that the wounds of Vietnam were healed, not in the fact the people of the U.S. never really dealt with what we did there, but how we are doing the same sorts of atrocities on civilians in Iraq, and it is like a scab has been pulled off. They want to believe the Swift vote vets.
Well, I think there's some truth there. I mean, this is what I was saying about how Kerry walked into an ambush, and I think it's interesting. What I tried to do on that TV program with them the other day was to actually raise the issue that nobody... People have been talking about Vietnam, but they haven't actually spoken about Vietnam, if you know what I mean. They're talking about the Vietnam War. But this was a war which killed 3 or 4 million civilians. This was a war which the U.S. lost. This was a war which most of the rest of the world, if it sounds familiar, opposed the United States and what it was doing. It was also a war against an opponent who wasn't necessarily the nicest and most democratic in the world, but that's another issue. Somehow, this had never been reconciled, and Vietnam here became an issue of who fought and whether they fought well, but significant proportions of Americans actually opposed the war at the time. A huge proportion now, almost everybody born since 1960, probably doesn't understand what the fuss is about. So this is a real sort of strange issue to be battling on. And I think what Kerry has failed to do was to come out kicking and say, I opposed the war because it was wrong. And he should have linked it with the current war, because all the signs are that what's happening in Iraq is an action replay of Vietnam. both in terms of the effects upon Americans dying there, on demoralization, on atrocities and war crimes being carried out. This is, and also even down to the false pretenses. Remember, the Vietnam War was started with false reports of an attack on the U.S. Navy in the Gulf of Tonkin, and this war was started by false reports of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So the parallels are actually quite frightening. And once again, you don't have to believe that Saddam Hussein was a good guy or that Ho Chi Minh was a sort of, you know, a charming uncle who never killed anyone in his life. There are sort of basic standards, and the U.S., the Vietnam War was wrong. Kerry should get up and say, I was right. He was right at the time. And he should say that the Iraq War is wrong now, and for the same reasons that I opposed the war then. I think he would get some resonance from people, but he's still hoping that he can win over the people, you know, sort of the people who supported the war or don't want to disavow it. He's still scared about what would happen in Middle America, where you cannot attack the military without it's like exposing yourself in public almost to suggest that the military is not always right.
You're listening to Sounds of Dissent on WZBC, Boston College Radio. My guest is Ian Williams. He is a veteran journalist, a media consultant, and the UN correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's also the author of a new book, Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. We are taking your questions if you call us at 617-552-3511. My colleague Tracy will take your question. I unfortunately don't have the ability to put you live on the phone with Mr. Williams, but Andrew from Cambridge asks, well, first I'll repeat the phone number, 617-552-3511. Andrew from Cambridge would like to know, what events do you think could get Bush elected? For instance, what foreign policy victories could help him now?
How shall we count the ways? One is that if he can get some idiots in New York to provoke a really big violent punch-up, there could be a backlash. And in fact, you could say he's got the idiots. The New York Police Department seems to be setting themselves up for the role. But they won't carry the fallback. It will be the demonstrators. Then I think it's frightening, a column I did, if you remember, what's his name with the turban? Do you remember Osama bin Laden, who was over all of the front pages, wanted posters on every TV screen for a year? No one's mentioned him for a year or two. So, you know, you can't help having this sneaking feeling that somewhere around October the 30th, suddenly Osama bin Laden will be found, dead or alive, and that gives 2 days before people can actually say, excuse me, what an amazing coincidence, but the newspapers will be filled with the actual fact of his delivery. Somebody else has pointed out that the U.S. Navy has actually scheduled maneuvers off North Korea in October, which very fortuitous. Who knows? I mean, there is a sort of, when you saw what happened in Florida last time, when you've seen what these people have done over the years, there really is an unscrupulousness about them, about hanging on to power. They really believe, in a fundamentalist way, that they are the people who should run this government, and that the elections are just a means of delivering them into office. So, they are the major flashpoints I would worry about. Lots of other concocted incidents, but I think they're the two that worry me the most.
Where can we find more information about your book? Is there
on
a link online?
On Amazon, on Powells.com. I think you'll find a lot of the websites. Alternet, for example, has had some, what I think, are good interviews in an extract. Buzzflash had some interviews, mediachannel.org. And the problem is, of course, that this being Nation Books, I think they have they probably have a negative advertising budget. The book has been selling on word of mouth and word of internet. So it's very gratifying to watch the hits. I just hope they translate into people buying the book.
And words on radio as well.
And words on radio, of course, as well, yes. But you can't touch a button on the radio and get a book delivered, unfortunately.
Well, again, the name of the book is Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. So thank you for being with us today, Mr. Williams.
Oh, thank you, Katrina. It was fun.
It's been great. And good luck in on
well,
the march
welcome
tomorrow.
To New York when you come.
Okay, maybe I'll see you.
In fact, tomorrow, if you're around at 6 o'clock at the Bowery Poetry Club, myself and Bill Hartung, another nation interviewer, are doing an event, an author. I am trying to compose Busherwolf, which is sort of a version of Beowulf adapted to the heroism of our commander-in-chief. In alliterative verse.
Oh, wow, that sounds very interesting. Where is that again?
That's at the Bowery Poetry Club in New York tomorrow. It's one of the many, many sort of countercultural events that are going on to take people's mind off the standing sore over on the Hudson, which is the Republican Convention.
There's many things going on tomorrow. My next guest is actually going to be with the group United for Justice with Peace. So we are going to thank you again for being with us here on Sounds of Dissent. And good luck tomorrow.
Right, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Again, you're listening to Sounds of Dissent here on Boston College Radio, 90.3 FM. I am Petrina, filling in for John Grebe today, and with the help of Tracy and Manjusri, we have been here since 11 and will be here up until 2 o'clock. And my next guest, Tony Palumba from United for Justice with Peace. He's with the local chapter organizing buses down to the RNC, and we'll have him on the line in just a moment. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You are listening to Sounds of Dissent here on WZBC Boston College Radio 90.3 FM in Newton, Boston. And I'm Petrina here filling in for John Grebe, who hosts this program, Sounds of Dissent, every Saturday from 11 to 1 right here on 90.3 FM. And if you go to our website, WZBC.org, you can follow along with our current playlist function, and we have links to what we've been talking about today and our guests. And we do need to fix the link to Dr. Best's website. We just need to take out the www in case anyone's trying to link over to Dr. Best's website. We'll fix that. But if you just take out the www, it will work for you. And we are taking your calls. My next guest is Tony Palumba. He is with the group United for Justice with Peace. He's from the local chapter. And he is part of the team that is organizing buses down to the march tomorrow. Welcome to Sounds of Dissent, Tony.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't you tell us about your role in organizing the buses and the role of the group, United for Justice
Peace? Sure. The United for Justice Peace, which is the regional coalition of many smaller community peace groups and organizations, has four buses actually leaving from different locations, a couple from the Boston Common and one from the North Shore going to Alewife. And then we have a bus which is part of the coalition, but I'm just happen to be coordinating that particular one from Watertown and then heading over to Arlington to pick up a bunch of folks, and then down we go to New York. So we're all pretty excited. Tomorrow's the day, 6:30 about a.m. most people will be jumping on buses.
Okay, well, I guess the first thing we should get is the information on the website and a phone number for...
Well, I should say, I'd be happy to give you a phone number.
Okay.
Just to say that there are very few buses left. I don't think there's any seats left, actually. What people are doing is they're being put on waiting lists right now to see. And I'm going to give you the UJP phone number, which is 617-491-4857. And let me, UJP, United for Justice with Peace, has their website, which is great to have just in terms of all the activities that are going on in Boston around peace and justice issues. It would be www.unitedforjustice.com.
Okay, unitedforjustice.com or .org?
I'm sorry, .org, I apologize.
Okay, that's okay. That is actually a tremendous website with lots of resources for anyone like myself who is going down to New York to remind you about things like bringing a little radio with you so
yes.
you can keep up with what's going on, make sure you bring water and a hat, and what other advice would you might give to someone?
Well, I think they should try to stay together. If they're going down in a bus, they should try to find a couple of folks on their bus they want to hang with for the day. They should also make sure, if they have cell phones, they should bring them and give the bus coordinator a cell phone so that they're, you know, if there's any problems in terms of getting back together at the end of the day, they can get in touch with people, and they should be really very careful about taking down some information before they leave their bus about their location and the time it comes back, so that they're prepared to meet with the bus and head on home wherever they're coming from. Now, there's a lot of buses down there. New York is going to be a pretty crowded place, and transportation is going to mostly be public transportation. Most of the buses are parking in lots outside of Manhattan. We're going to be parking Shea Stadium and taking the subway system into Manhattan, making sure we're at the beginning of the rally site, the march site, and marched past the Madison Square Garden and the RCN and heading up at Union Square.
And there are, I've seen on the website, some restrictions, like they're going to be closing some of the entrances to Penn Station and can only enter from the south, I think.
Yeah, the best thing would be to find whatever T-stop your subway system you're using is to find it, try to end up close to 14th Street.
Okay.
That's the general convening area is a little larger, but if you're near 14th Street, 15th Street, you should be fine. Try not to come in from the north, which is through Penn, because that's where closer to where we end as opposed to where we begin. So try to get to the subways that take you down further into down to 14th Street.
And I'd also like to ask you to comment about the march and the rally, which the rally, I guess, is not happening.
Yeah, the rally is not officially happening. The march is, and the march will begin at, as I say, at the corner of 14th and 7th Avenue and continue on down past the Madison Square Garden and end up over at Union Station, Union Station, where they will be doing a silent vigil. And the people in New York and United for Peace with Justice, the UPJ organization that has sort of put this whole thing together, really would appreciate if folks stayed with the march and right to the end, and then once they got to Union Station, had their moment of silence, and then dispersed so that everybody else in the march could move up and kind of have their moment of silence and so forth. And then after that, people are pretty much on their own. What some folks are going to be doing is walking in small groups. They'll have a picnic up at Central Park. Others may kind of go see what the rest of New York looks like for a little while. But there's no official official happening, no official rally at this point, other than the closing this moment of silence at Union Square.
Okay,
Union Station.
So I guess we should clarify that the group that you're with, United for Justice with Peace,
right,
is a local, is it a local chapter of the National?
Yeah, well, there's 600, no, there's actually 800 members of the larger United for Peace with Justice organization that sits in New York and was responsible for the February 15th post, right before the war opened, the massive The World Says No to War in Iraq. And they've been, you know, mobilizing and organizing for about a year and a half, and it's almost 2 years. And they are the ones that have, you know, link all the groups around the nation, at least who feel like they're part of that larger coalition. Locally here in the Boston area, there's another group. As I say, it's a regional coalition called United for Justice with Peace. And I think I gave you the www.wrong. It's www.justicewithpeace.org. I get them mixed up sometimes.
Yeah,
it's justicewithpeace.org.
That's the local one.
That's the local one, and they are, you know, they represent approximately, I'm not sure the figure right now, but I know that Watertown Citizens for Environmental Safety, which is where I'm with, Arlington, UJP, and Cambridge, and groups in Acton and Marlboro, and I mean, they represent a lot of smaller community-based peace and justice organizations, and so they're the ones who've taken responsibility for organizing the buses and trying to help people get to New York.
And we are taking your questions. If
Please.
You have a question for Tony Palumba, my guest is with the group United for Justice with Peace, and the phone number you can call 617-552-3511. If you have a question for Tony, you can call that number. And again, the number is 617-552-3511. You can also follow along with us on our online playlist system. If you go to WZBC.org and click on Current Playlist, you can see information about our guests today here on Sounds of Dissent. Again, I'm Petrina filling in for John Grebe, and we'll be here until 2. We have an extended program today. And another question I had for you, Tony, was about why the rally isn't happening. What's the story?
Well, the rally
story
isn't happening because the mayor of New York is trying to stifle dissent. I mean, there's not too many ways to describe this. This is a real injustice. And even a paper as mainstream as the New York Times has editorialized at least 3 different editorials against the prohibition that Mayor Bloomberg has raised about not allowing United for Peace with Justice to have a rally on Central Park. Now, this is the same Central Park where you have concerts. This is the same Central Park that in 1982, for the massive anti-nuclear war demonstration, almost 1 million people came. This is a straight, clear violation of the right to assembly and the right to free speech. And everybody in New York, whether even, I mean, the overwhelming majority of citizens in New York taken by a recent poll indicated that we should have the right to be in Central Park. And so this is a real, I think it's not only our desire to be present tomorrow to oppose the Bush agenda. And I should mention that the rally tomorrow, the march in, is really not just focused on Iraq, though that is one of the main areas of the U.S. War in Iraq, but it is a much broader group of people who are coming together, people who oppose the Bush administration's environmental policy, their social spending policy, their national security policy, the opposed the Patriot Act and the violation of civil liberties. So it's a broad group, even though there are other demonstrations taking place throughout the 4 days of the convention. I think we should just be aware of that, and most of us can't stay down there, but there's the next day, Monday, there's a large anti-poverty AIDS march that's taking place. The following day, I believe there's a big union march. There's some planned civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience planned on one day. And then there's just, I could say hundreds, but a lot of cultural events and activities, conferences, film showings, independent political actions, people draping signs, people in New York putting signs in their windows, and a lot of activity that basically is telling Bush, this is not the place to come to take advantage of 9/11 for your political benefit. You should be in New York. And but to return just to the issue of what was really a blatant violation of civil liberties. And there's no reason why we cannot go to Central Park. There's just no reason. This is a nonviolent, peaceful demonstration. It's a demonstration that parents and people with disabilities and elderly people are going to be marching in. There's no intention to do anything to violate the law, and they have a permit for the march. We should have had a permit to rally. And some folks, I think, are just going to go visit the park as if they were going to go have a picnic. But right. There will be no central location, no sound system, no. But out of principle, people should have the right to be in Central Park, and some people are going to follow that principle.
So as far as the permits go, what was the... Is that a new thing in the past few years? Well,
they've been very difficult ever since.
I didn't know you had to get a permit for these things.
Oh, geez,
this is news to me.
You had to get a lot of permits. And in Boston, during the DNC, we already had permits, and then they went through a long process of getting permits, not only for the what was later considered a pen, and then very few people used, but for that location near the... near the delegates and the Fleet Center, but we have permits for use of any other place in Boston, whether it be Copley Square at Boston Common, at Blackstone Park. You always have to get these permits, and sometimes they make it easy and sometimes they make it hard, and if it's been consistently making it hard, February 15th they made it hard. It wasn't up to the end that they were clear about the march route. This one they're making almost impossible for organizers. They offered the organizers a West Side Highway, which originally they accepted and then turned down after people took a closer look at what it would mean to take folks out to the West Side Highway. No water out there, no stores, no transportation. It's kind of not a place to put a lot of people. And they decided to not take that as their compromise. The police have been very uncompromising about this, not willing to negotiate, not willing to talk, and then when they are, they're pretty take-it-or-leave-it kind of attitude towards the organizers. And it's been a pretty big mess, to be honest, and it makes it very hard to organize, and then partially this is intimidation. This is what people do to intimidate people from not coming, and this has played out also in all the right-wing talk shows and so forth. I was on a show the other day that, you know, the host was primarily saying, you're going to have violence, right? And was just basically pushing me to say, yes, that's why we're all going to New York, to have violence. And how can you not have violence with 250,000 people? And so this just, all this is intimidation to stifle people's right to dissent and make it hard for people to make that commitment to get on a bus or to get on a train. And even if our buses aren't filled, you know, to take the bus from Chinatown, which is cheap, I think it's $10, or to find a way to get down through Greyhound or Amtrak. It's all, and actually I think it's backfiring. To be honest, I really think it's backfiring. I think the restrictions on the use of Central Park have made more New Yorkers angry, and I think it's going to bring more people to the march than they expected.
Well, what do you think of the theory then that they almost might have done it on purpose to make it look chaotic and make the dissenters look unorganized? Or?
Well, I think they do a lot of things that make life difficult and make organizing, basic organizing, difficult. And I think that, you know, restrictions are one of the things that make people upset and can intimidate people, but also can make other people feel like turning to more drastic measures. I don't you know, some of it is planned. I don't think there's any big conspiracy about it. They're just out to make it hard, and that's pretty clear and pretty obvious. And they let human nature follow that course after that. And I think wisely we and people down in New York who we, through United for Peace with Justice, have done their best to negotiate what they can negotiate, and we're going to have a great march. And like I said, people will either then leave the Union Station area and wander around New York for a little while, try to find another event that's taking place. I'm not, you know, there's a web page you could go to, United for, not our local one, you could go to the national one, and see they have a click on where you can find other activities that are happening around the RNC. There might be one or two happening on Sunday besides us. Well, people will go to Central Park. They'll take a picnic basket or, you know, pick up a couple of sandwiches and go sit in Central Park and at least in a symbolic way tell Bloomberg, you're not going to tell us not to be there. That's how I think it's going to play out.
I also saw a very comprehensive media guide, the unofficial media guide to the 2004 Republican National Convention. I actually printed it out for myself as I am heading down to the RNC.
Oh, great.
And it's quite an interesting document,
yeah.
mediachannel.org. And there's lots of information about New York and what's going on.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, the number of events, the cultural events, the activities, the different groups that are planning things. I just don't understand. Well, I do understand why, but I think New York is responding appropriately. That you know, that this is not a Republican town. And if you were going to have your national convention to renominate your incumbent, whether duly elected or not, why would you pick such a Democratic town? Otherwise, to play off the tragedy of 9/11, and I think people find that wrong. And you know, I think New Yorkers overwhelmingly don't want the RNC there.
So again, it's justicewithpeace.org is the website for the local chapter, and the national one is
UnitedForPeace.org. You just run that together, UnitedForPeace.org,
okay.
And I'll take you to the national. There you could go to a number of different things besides information about the RNC. They have their information about their coming events, and they have a great Iraq Watch, which is a link to another wonderful website for groups who are sort of watching what's taking place in Iraq around not only civilian casualties, but around contracts and just generally keeping track of what's happening there.
Okay, great. Well, my guest is Tony Palumba here on Sounds of Dissent. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
And we'll see you at the march tomorrow.
See you there. Okay.
Okay,
right.
Thanks, Tony.
Bye.
And again, you're listening to Boston College Radio, 90.3 FM. I'm Petrina here with you, filling in for John Grebe on Sounds of Dissent. And I have some wonderful help today from Tracy and Manjusri. And I'm going to play a song while we get ready for some headlines. We're going to be on until 2 o'clock, so stay with us. Listening to Sounds of Dissent here on Boston College Radio, and I'd like to thank all of our guests today, and I'd also like to thank Tracy and Manjusri. And John Grebe is on his way down to the Republican National Convention right now. I'll be heading there later, and I would like to remind you that you still can head down. You'd need to find a bus of some kind, a Greyhound or the Chinese bus or something like that, but the march is tomorrow in New York City, and the convention happens all week. And you can hear news about the convention right here on 90.3 FM. Tomorrow morning on Sounds of Dissent, there will be, I will call in from the rally tomorrow at 9:30 on No U-Turn Radio, which airs every Sunday morning from 6 a.m. till 10 a.m. And tomorrow morning you should tune in. And on the weekdays, we have the program Democracy Now at noon, Monday through Friday. And I'm pretty sure this week they'll be producing two-hour programs instead of the regular one-hour program. So that's noon every weekday here on WZBC 90.3 FM, Democracy Now! With your host, Amy Goodman. And again, No U-Turn Radio is Sunday morning, so that's tomorrow morning. Tune in for a live update from the march at 9:30. And as I mentioned before, we have an extended program today, Sounds of Dissent, going till 2 o'clock. And this one is taken from The Guardian of London. The FBI probes if officials spied for Israel. The FBI probes if officials spied for Israel. And this is from today, and it's by Kurt Anderson. Again, it's from, this article is from The Guardian of London. The FBI is investigating whether an analyst for the Pentagon's number three official acted as a spy for Israel, giving the Jewish state classified materials about secret White House deliberations on Iran. Two federal law enforcement officials said Friday. No arrests have been made, said the officials, speaking on condition of anonymity because the investigation is continuing. But a third law enforcement official, also speaking anonymously, said an arrest in the case could come as early as next week. The officials refused to identify the Pentagon employee who was under investigation, but said the person works in the office of Douglas J. Feith, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy at the Pentagon. Feith is a key aide to Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld, working on sensitive policy issues, including U.S. policy toward Iraq and Iran. There are slightly more than a handful of people in Feith's office who specifically work on Iranian issues. The investigation centers on whether the employee in Feith's office passed secrets about Bush administration policy toward Iran to the main pro-Israeli lobbying group in Washington, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, which then allegedly gave them to the Israeli government. One official said, David Siegel, a spokesman for the Israeli embassy in Washington, "We categorically deny these allegations. They are completely false and outrageous." The investigation, first reported by CBS News, has included wiretapping and surveillance and searches of the Pentagon employee's computer, the law enforcement officials said. Despite the close U.S.-Israeli relations, this is not the first allegation of spying by Israel. Jonathan Pollard, a former naval intelligence officer who gave top secret documents to Israel, has been a point of contention in U.S.-Israeli relations. The Israeli government has repeatedly pressed for his release, but intelligence officials have called the information he passed to the Israelis highly damaging. Pollard was caught in Washington in November 1985 and was arrested after unsuccessfully seeking refuge at the Israeli embassy. A congressional aide declined to say if the Senate Intelligence Committee had been briefed on the case, but said the panel is generally briefed on espionage cases. You're listening to Sounds of Dissent here on Boston College Radio 90.3 FM, and I'm Petrina, filling in for John Grebe. We've had some interviews here today, and we heard some news programs from Counterspin and also Between the Lines. If you'd like to follow along with what we're doing, you can go to our website, wzbc.org, and go to the current playlist function, and you can find links and information about our guests today. And again, I'd like to thank Tracy and Manjushri for their help. And in just a few moments, we'll have a few more headlines for you. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sounds of Dissent on Boston College Radio 90.3. And we have a follow-up article to what I was just reading about. The name of the Israeli spy has been revealed. The FBI probe targets Pentagon official. This article is by Bradley Graham and Thomas E. Ricks. It's from the Washington Post, and it's from today, August 28th. The FBI is investigating a mid-level Pentagon official who specializes in Iranian affairs for allegedly passing classified information to Israel, and arrests in the case could come as early as next week, officials at the Pentagon and other government agencies said last night. The name of the person under investigation was not officially released, but two sources identified him as Larry Franklin. He was described as a desk officer in the Pentagon's Near East and South Asia Bureau, one of six regional policy sections. Franklin worked at the Defense Intelligence Agency before moving to the Pentagon's policy branch 3 years ago and is nearing retirement, the officials said. Franklin could not be located for comment last night. One government official familiar with the investigation said it is not yet clear whether the case will rise to the level of espionage or end up involving lesser charges, such as improper disclosure or mishandling of classified information. So that article is sent to us by contributor Manjusri, and that is an article published by the Washington Post today. And I have a few more headlines for you here on Sounds of Dissent. Something published in China View. 14 Nepalese taken hostage in Iraq. At a time when 12 Nepalese have been taken hostage by a militant group in Iraq, another group of 14 Nepalese citizens who entered into Iraq illegally have been arrested in Iraq, the Nepali Foreign Ministry said here Thursday. The Iraqi embassy in New Delhi, which also looks after Nepal, informed that 14 Nepalese were arrested in Iraq, and we are trying to get detailed information about them, the ministry said in a statement without giving details. Meanwhile, the Nepali government has sent a formal letter to the Iraqi government requesting it to initiate appropriate mediation to secure the release of Nepali hostages. The 12 Nepalese kept hostage by the Iraqi insurgents in a videotaped telecast by the well-known Arabian Al Jazeera television appealed to the Nepali government to initiate all possible steps to rescue them. They also appealed to the government to take stern action against the Moonlight Manpower Company, a foreign employment agent who forced them to go to Iraq despite their unwillingness to go there. You're listening to Sounds of Dissent on Boston College Radio 90.3 FM, and I'm Petrina here filling in for John Grevy with the help of Tracy and Manjusri. And I just have a couple more headlines for you, and then we'll play another episode of Election Watch 04, The War on Terror. And then Robin will be in to do Ragamuffin International. Again, our website is wzbc.org, and if you have any questions for us, give us a call at 617-552-3511. Our next story comes from the New York Times editorial section, Economic Reality Bites. If anyone required further evidence that President Bush's fiscal policies have not worked the way he says they have, this week's report from the Census Bureau provided it. In brief, from 2001 through 2003, poverty increased, income stagnated, and the ranks of the uninsured grew, while the United States spent some $400 billion on tax cuts, which mainly benefited wealthy families. The Bush administration seemed intent on minimizing the political impact of the report, releasing the data on Thursday instead of the usual date in late September to get it done before the convention. But the numbers spoke for themselves. Since Mr. Bush came to power, 4.3 million people have fallen below the poverty line, set at $18,660 for a family of four in 2003, bringing the total number of people living in poverty in 2003 to 35.9 million, or 12.5% of the American population. A Bush campaign official suggested that the census report was misleading because it did not reflect the economic growth of the past 11 months. In fact, the report covers all of 2003, and in three of the 7 months of 2004, for which data is available, job growth has not been strong enough to even keep up with population growth. Moreover, a Commerce Department report released yesterday showed that economic momentum slowed in the spring, with the economy expanding at a rate of only 2.8%, the slowest advance in more than a year, versus 3.0% as originally reported. The downward revision reflects June's record trade deficit of $55.8 billion. It remains to be seen whether this week's bad economic news turns out to be bad political news for Mr. Bush. But for tens of millions of Americans, it is already old news. Again, you're listening to Sounds of Dissent, and we're reading some headlines from the news today. Economic Reality Bites is the name of that article, as published by the New York Times, nytimes.com, and we have a couple more. Let's see what we have sent in from Manjusri. The Al Jazeera reports yesterday that the Najaf standoff ends. Peace accord. Al-Sistani reportedly persuaded Al-Sadr late on Thursday to accept a deal ending the fighting in Najaf. The accord would demilitarize Najaf and neighboring Kufa, with both U.S.-led troops and al-Mahdi army fighters withdrawing on Friday. The revered Imam Ali Mosque will be placed under the stewardship of Iraq's most senior Shia Muslim religious authorities, headed by Iranian-born cleric Al-Sistani. Al-Sistani, who left for London to receive medical treatment just as the Najaf fighting erupted last month, returned to Iraq on Wednesday. Under British and Iraqi government escort, he led a convoy of followers into Najaf on Thursday to negotiate a peace agreement. But the refusal so far of the al-Mahdi army to disarm and disband across the country remains a potential obstacle. If it succeeds, the accord will end a serious challenge to the authority of Alawi's fledgling government, which continues to battle resistance elsewhere in the country and is struggling to maintain vital oil imports. So there's a headline for you there from the Al Jazeera, and you can go to english.aljazeera.net for more of that article. And let's see, finally from the Independent in the UK, we have an article. Shot at, bombed, and declared traitors by both sides, Najaf ambulance men fight losing battle. This article is by Donald McIntyre, and it's from the Independent UK from August 26th. Abu Sadiq can reasonably claim to have one of the most thankless and dangerous jobs in the world. He has been beaten up every day. He braves shooting from all sides to do his work, and he gets paid a mere $65 a month. For Abu Sadiq is one of Najaf's 80 ambulance men who risk their lives every day to bring the injured and dying to Al-Hakeen Hospital, the only one of the three main hospitals in the city functioning for civilians. At 39, Abu Sadiq has been an ambulance man for 15 years, but this is the first time he has been caught up in a conflict in which both sides regard him as an enemy. The Mehdi army call me a traitor and say I'm with the police. The police say I'm with the Mehdi army, he explained. Three ambulance men have been killed since the present battle began 3 weeks ago, one by a mortar attack on the room at the hospital the drivers and paramedics used between calls. 13 of the city's 32 ambulances have been destroyed. Again, that article is from the Independent in the UK, and you're listening to the program Sounds of Dissent here on WZBC Boston College Radio. And again, our guests from today have been Tony Palumba from United for... I'm getting these all confused now. United for Justice with Peace, the local chapter. And we also heard from journalist Ian Williams, who has a new book called Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. He is a veteran journalist, media consultant, and the UN correspondent for The Nation magazine. And we heard from Dr. Stephen Best, who is the chair of philosophy at the University of Texas at El Paso, who is the author of a new book called Terrorists or Freedom Fighters, Reflections on the Liberation of Animals. And I'd like to thank Tracy and Manjusri and John for all their help today. I'm Petrina, filling in on Sounds of Dissent. John Grebe will return next week. And remember that tomorrow morning, No U-Turn Radio will be broadcasting from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. with a live call-in from the rally in New York City. I will call in at about 9:30 and talk with Richard, and Stan isn't here this week, but so it's tomorrow morning right here on 90.3 FM, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. And then throughout the week at noon, there'll be special two-hour reports from Democracy Now, Monday through Friday at noon, right here on 90.3 FM. And we will now hear from the program that is called Election Watch 04. This is from the May episode. And let's see, Election Watch 04 on terror. After September 11th, 2001, the Bush administration created controversial policy at home and abroad in the name of homeland security. So here we have the radio program, Election Watch 04, War on Terror.
This week on Making Contact.
The United States Constitution is under attack. Under attack from the President of the United States himself. This is not simply an issue, but becomes a subject for the election.
After September 11th, 2001, the Bush administration created controversial policy at home and abroad in the name of homeland security. Increased surveillance, security searches, and military intervention in the Middle East have changed life in the United States. And many Arab, South Asian, and Muslim Americans have experienced an even greater reduction of civil liberties. On this Election Watch 04 edition, we'll take a look at how communities most impacted by Bush's war on terror will vote in the upcoming 2004 elections, how the Patriot Act is playing a role in the election year, and the constitutionality of the war in Iraq. I'm Amy Palmer-Logue, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Since 9/11, hundreds of Arab and South Asian immigrants have been forced into special registration, leading to arbitrary detention and deportation. Others have experienced discrimination and been victims of hate crimes. Now, in the upcoming 2004 presidential elections, leaders in the Muslim American community say this post-9/11 environment will influence their vote. Studies say the Arab American vote may have the power to swing the elections. Correspondent Pauline Bartolone has this report.
Tanzila Ahmed is a 24-year-old Bangladeshi American from Los Angeles. After graduating from college, she moved to Washington, D.C. to pursue a youth organizing job. About a year after September 11th, 2001, Ahmed got an alarming phone call.
My mom called me, and she's like, "Something happened, but I don't want to tell you." I was like, "What are you talking about? Just tell me." She goes, "Well, Homeland Security came and knocked on our door. They were asking that about my cousin and if he was really born in America and if they had proof. Because our last name's Ahmed, and so his name was Nabil Ahmed, and so it was high on the list of terrorist names." But it's just really frustrating because he was born in the same hospital as I was in Southern California in La Mirada.
Ahmed said it was hard for her to be 3,000 miles away from her South Asian American family in California after 9/11. In the face of counterterrorism policies such as the Patriot Act, she felt her community had little political voice, and she wanted that to change.
The most disheartening thing she said that day was that even in this country, even after having to go through citizenship, she still felt like a second-class citizen.
After the conversation with her mother, Ahmed returned to her parents' house in L.A., and started SAVI, South Asian American Voting Youth, a national grassroots organization to facilitate voting in the population of 2 million.
Up till now, we've been this ignored community, which has slightly been paid attention to, but not really. And I think, really, after creating that political voice for our community, that people will have to start paying attention to us. And that's really one of the bigger steps to, you know, advocating for civil liberties, is to get organized.
South Asian Americans are not the only population hit with the realities of the U.S. war on terror. Many Arab Americans feel disillusioned with the political process. Samina Fahim is the executive director of American Muslim Voice.
When the president started this war on terror, we had no problem with that, as long as it was war on terror. But very quickly it became war against Muslims, Islams, Arabs, and South Asians. And Patriot Act, INS Special Legislation, those are some of the examples that how we were directly affected by that. A lot of the people say, well, Patriot Act has not done any damage to anybody. They have not abused that. But I say, Patriot Act is a sword that is hanging over Muslims, Arabs, and South Asians at all times. And it has silenced the whole community.
In 2000, Arab Americans overwhelmingly voted Republican in response to an outreach effort by then-candidate George W. Bush. Bush met with several Arab American and Muslim leaders, promising to outlaw the use of secret evidence in government detentions.
The use of secret evidence was something that Bush raised in one of his debates, and that resonated with the community, and they very much thought that, oh, President Bush is going to be speaking our language. Now, obviously, you know, a lot of things have changed since then.
Leila Al-Khatami is with the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, or the ADC.
But the policies that have come out of the administration and some of the things that people associated with the administration have been saying, there's a lot of, you know, racism that has been articulated by people associated with the administration, like a General Boykin, you know, saying that people who are Muslims are, you know, our spiritual enemy. Ashcroft has said some really defamatory things against Islam. So what you'll find is, although President Bush has, you know, made a number of comments talking about Islam as a peaceful religion and kind of making symbolic gestures to the Arab American and the Muslim American communities, what the community itself is seeing is something very different. They've borne the brunt of, you know, most of the civil liberties infringements. So it kind of everything has changed for the community, and they're looking to get away from that and, you know, go with somebody who is, again, at this time, speaking our language.
According to a report conducted in April 2004 by Zogby International, Arab Americans have the power to swing the 2004 presidential election. 85% of Arab Americans are registered to vote, compared to the general population's national average of 64%. In the study, Arab Americans were polled in four states where the election is expected to be particularly close: Florida, Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Each state has a large Arab American population. In the poll, the Democratic Party won 45% support of participating Arab Americans, with the Republican Party only receiving 29%. In 2000, the voting percentages were almost exactly the opposite, favoring Republicans. ADC's Khatami.
The war on terror, and also the failure to come up with any tangible or just and durable resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is something that is pushing Arab Americans to think about electing someone new. In fact, most of the data that we've seen, the polling data that we've seen, says very much that the community thinks very seriously. I think overwhelming, 65% say that they are interested in electing somebody new.
But Fahim of American Muslim Voice says it's not clear that either candidate will advocate for the civil liberties of the Muslim community.
A lot of the people are totally disillusioned about that, that they don't think that they could make any difference, because it is not very clear who is actually for civil liberties. Democrats usually are, you know, more pro-immigrants and more pro-civil liberties and all that. But this year, I don't see, and I think a lot of the community doesn't see, a very clear message. I think the best way to talk about voting is to not talk about voting.
For Ahmed, voting is about creating a unified political voice for the South Asian American community, not just about getting people to the polls.
Obviously, people are disillusioned by the voting process if you just look at it as simply a voting process. The way that we've been organizing around it is not, you know, not saying this is a voting campaign, but saying this is a campaign against South Asian discrimination. This is something about hate crimes and racial profiling and affirmative action and increase of cost of education for schools. This is about creating a political voice so that your issues can actually get heard. Once you start bringing it down to issues, that's when people actually start caring about voting.
For Making Contact, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
In September 2001, Bush and Congress adopted sweeping anti-terror policies that critics say have cast a long shadow over the civil liberties of U.S. citizens. This election year, there's a political struggle over the expiration of certain laws in the Patriot Act. Both Senator John Kerry and President Bush addressed the Patriot Act sunset laws in their campaigns. Bush has toured several states and is campaigning to extend provisions of the Patriot Act set to expire next year. Senator Kerry has signed on to a bill that challenges some of the controversial aspects of the Patriot Act. Meanwhile, what some civil liberties experts find troubling this election year is the covert effort to push the Domestic Security Enhancement Act 2003, formerly known as Patriot Act 2. Correspondent Jeff Brady has more.
In late April, the Bush campaign toured several states. In his speeches, Bush says the Patriot Act is set to expire next year. However, only about 10% of the Patriot Act is set to end December 2005. The rest is permanent. Among the Patriot Act sunset provisions are the use of national security letters, which allow the FBI to seize records from a variety of places without going to court, and the use of a roving wiretap without judicial safeguards.
Wiretaps, I think, are the most nasty thing that's almost come out of the Patriot Act.
Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, says the roving wiretap is subject to the widest abuse possible.
They basically are keeping track of you and everything you do by using roving wiretaps, because they want to say, well, if he's going to be a terrorist and make a call to somebody, I don't know when he's going to do it. He may do it at 8 in the morning. He may do it at 8 at night. He may do it when he's playing cards. He may do it at the baseball game. The interesting question here is then what they do with the information they learn. Can they use that evidence or not? Well, they might not use it because they don't want to expose that they're wiretapping that friend, but they very well might. And while there used to be a strict wall between what they could use these special wiretaps for, which it used to be you could only use them for intelligence and not criminal prosecution, but that wall has come down.
Ratner says the danger is that intelligence agents have an incentive here, not only for alleged international terrorism, but for regular crime as well. However, a bipartisan-sponsored bill introduced to Congress last year may allow for a debate on these controversial areas of the Patriot Act. While Senator Kerry voted for the Patriot Act initially, he has signed on to the Security and Freedom Insured Act, or the SAFE Act. The SAFE Act is supported by a diverse group, liberal and conservative, including the Gun Owners of America, the American Library Association, and the American Civil Liberties Union, among others. Charlie Mitchell, legislative counsel for the ACLU, says the SAFE Act would limit the broad use of roving wiretap powers.
It tries to protect the privacy and conversations of the innocent folks while allowing the FBI to do its job and follow suspects. I mean, and the fact that they're arguing against the civil liberties community on these small protections for the roving wiretap really shows how extreme some of their positions have become.
One individual was being surveilled, happened to have been an individual who was surveilled on national security grounds, but literally while being surveilled, and I believe it was on a phone surveillance, murdered his daughter.
In a recorded testimony, Attorney General John Ashcroft cites this case, which is on the extreme end, to argue the broad use of wiretapping powers before the House Judiciary Committee oversight hearing last year.
Frankly, we didn't feel like it was inappropriate to charge the person with murdering his daughter. As a matter of fact, that's the way in which the investigation went. We take a look at the entirety of the facts, and we look at the national interest, and we assess what kinds of prosecution will best serve the national interest.
Last year, a bill formerly known as the Patriot Act II was leaked to Congress and met with a firestorm of opposition. It was later introduced as the Domestic Security Enhancement Act. Civil liberties experts say that Patriot Act-type powers are being covertly added to other legislation. So far, one law was passed under the radar, says Michael Ratner.
They've added broader administrative subpoena power to the Patriot Act, really, giving the FBI the right to really get financial records from all kinds of institutions, everywhere from your used car dealer when you buy a car to a pawn shop to anywhere that keeps financial records.
Kevin Bankston with the Electronics Frontier Foundation.
You're listening to Sounds of Dissent here on WZBC, Boston College Radio. For more information for the Center for Constitutional Rights, you can go to humanrightsnow.org. We have to interrupt the Election Watch program that we're airing right now because we've run out of time for Sounds of Dissent here on Boston College Radio. Ragamuffin International is about to begin, but once again, I'd like to thank Tracy Manjusri and John for being part of Sounds of Dissent today. My name is Petrina, and I've been filling in for your host, John Grebe. He will return next week from 11 to 1, and I'm sure he'll have lots of stories from the RNC, where he is heading right now. I'm heading there myself, and we'll be calling in tomorrow morning at about 9:30 for a live report from the march, and that will be during No U-Turn Radio with your host, Richard, filling in for Stan. So that's tomorrow at 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. right here on 90.3 FM. And the website again for the buses to the RNC is justicewithpeace.org. And our website once again is wzbc.org. You can use the current playlist function to see links and information about our guests here on Sounds of Dissent. And now I have a 2-minute piece for you by United for a Fair Economy. And this is called The BBs of Wealth. Chuck Collins, co-director of United for a Fair Economy, sonically demonstrates the wealth gap between the super rich and average Americans by pouring BBs into a metal stockpot. So here's an interesting 2-minute piece to close out Sounds of Dissent for today. Thanks for being with us.
This is Chuck Collins from United for a Fair Economy in Boston. We've heard that there is a growing gap between the very wealthy and everyone else. What does wealth inequality sound like? The sound that you are about to hear is a BB falling into a metal soup pot. Each BB represents $500 in net worth. If we took all the private wealth in the United States and divided it evenly among all the 100 million households, each household's share would sound like this. That was the sound of 500 BBs, the equivalent of about $250,000 for every household. But as you know, wealth is not evenly distributed. If we were to take the wealth of the bottom 50 million households and average it out, here is what it would sound like. That was 10 BBs, the sound representing $5,000. On the other end of the spectrum, let's listen to the average wealth of the richest 1% of households. To join the richest 1%, you need to have about $2.6 million or more. Here's what their share of wealth sounds like. That was the sound of wealth inequality, where the richest 1% of households has an average of $10 million, and the average 50 million households in the bottom, over half the population, has an average of $5,000 in net worth.
Well, does that not say it in a nutshell? Ba-dum bump. Big respect going out to Petrina, holding down Sounds of Dissent, and boy, for all the shows to fill in for, this one is a major show to fill in for. So big respect is always going out to Petrina and everybody that's helped her. As she said, John Grebe will be back next week. They're off to the RNC, and as I said to Petrina, go yell for me, please. Actually, it's interesting. I used to live 3 blocks away from Madison Square Garden, and they're absolutely freezing the entire place, and I can't even imagine it. I wonder if the college students are moving into the college where I lived right there. Going to be interesting to see what happens at the RNC.